During the global pandemic, does it feel maybe like the days are going slowly, even though the year went by quickly? Or maybe you feel like you've been repeating the same day over and over again, like Groundhog Day. Violinist Gregory Harrington decided to explore this concept through two works by Philip Glass that appear on his new recording, Glass Hour. He did this with conductor Mark Shapiro, and they traveled to the Czech Republic to make the recording with the Janáček Philharmonic. You'll hear about it on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Gregory, you were born in Dublin, and now you call New York City home. Can you talk a little bit about your path, how you got from Ireland to the U.S. with respect to your professional career, I'm guessing?
Yes, indeed. So, Julie, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show and having Mark on the show. Pleasure to be here. I grew up in Dublin. I was 4 years old when my mother took me into the RDS Horse Show, which is this wonderful international jumping show. And I saw a string quartet play. And I just was so drawn to the idea of the violin. And I tugged her arm. I was knee high to a grasshopper, as they say at home. Tugged her arm and I pointed it. And I just said I wanted to play that. So she brought me in the very next day and bought me a violin. And I studied in the Royal Irish Academy of Music until I was 18, and did a couple of competitions at home, and with varying success, of very well and not so very well. And, you know, did my debut in concert hall and whatnot in the RTE Concert Orchestra. I actually studied business and Spanish in UCD instead of music. And then I was going over once a month to England for lessons. And then after that, I came over to New York just to continue my studies and auditioned. And yeah, that's how I arrived in New York.
How did the violin become your instrument of choice? I mean, you saw a string quartet that inspired you, so it could have been any one of those instruments.
That's very true, yes. I think I loved the sonority of the violin, even at a very young age. And that was sort of helped with mom and dad playing records at home and hearing the first recording I think I heard was Heifetz. And there's just something mesmerizing and mesmeric about his sound and what he can do with the violin. And I think that I was just fascinated by what that sound was. So I think that was the journey that sort of led me towards violin. And Dad then was very, you know, encouraging and enthusiastic about that. And I remember seeing Yuri Menuhin play the Beethoven Concerto with the European Youth Orchestra. And that was just an incredible memory to see him live do that. Even though he was so old, it was just phenomenal to see. So I think, yeah, I think it was just fostered. And my teacher, my first teacher, Kevin Kiley, was just, in hindsight, you know, wonderful at introducing the right material and the right hook to keep me going forward and just, you know, have this curiosity and an internal just wish to want to know more and want to know how to explore this incredible instrument.
You have had the opportunity to perform in some rather non-traditional venues. And one of those, well, actually a couple of those, right? A St. Patrick's Day parade, an NFL football game. And these were in outdoor settings, very cold. So you had to do some special preparation. Can you talk a little bit about how you did that?
This is true. So from opening the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York on Fifth Avenue in 22 degree weather, where you get the signal to go live and you just realize, actually, I can't feel either hand, right? So it's quite an interesting exercise in control to, you know, playing NFL games and whatnot. One that sticks out, well, there's two that stick out, but when you speak of cold, I performed in Lambeau Field, which is the Green Bay Packers. And it wasn't September or October where the heat is there. It was the beginning of December. So it was freezing. And we did a sound check at 9 a.m. in the morning in the shadow. So it was just miserable. And I remember that the producer just got into my ear and he said, Greg, do you realize that this isn't actually sounding delightful. Right? And my attitude was, in a very polite way, tell me something I don't already know, right? And I had been practicing with my hands in ice cubes, ready to go and back and forth. And, you know, I had a beautiful Lewis and Clark carbon fiber violin, you know, and then I went back up to the suite to practice. And just before I went on, the players have this massive burner, heater, right? And I had the hand packs, I had everything, and it really wasn't working. And when you're in front of 80,000 people, the option to fail really isn't an option, right? So it's all about, you got to figure it out right here, right now. So I was lucky enough where I had the heater and it kept me going for about 3.5 minutes before my hands froze again. But it was an electric experience having, you know, that moment 15 or 20 seconds in where you know you have 80,000 people following you and into it. And yeah, it was wonderful.
You also had the honor to perform for our current president, Joe Biden, when he was vice president. What was most memorable about that experience?
It was for the American Ireland Hall of Fame. And he was in New York giving a speech. And I had flown my dad over for this because, you know, Dad loved coming to different events, whether it was touring China or at Mexico or wherever. He'd always fly in for about 48 hours and we'd have this really, really special time. But he came over for that. And at the time, Vice President Biden, his great-grandfather, Ambrose, was born in County Louth in Ireland. So I wanted to pick a piece that really connected to him. So I did an arrangement of Turlough O'Carolan's, the O'Carolan Concerto. You know, President Biden's great-grandfather was a blind fiddler. So this was by a blind Irish composer, you know, so it was a beautiful connection. So when we spoke afterwards, he was just so very gracious and so warm. And, you know, the first thing he said to me, he said, people don't really understand how difficult it is, those that don't stand on stage, how difficult it is to be on stage and to connect with others. You know, and he spoke about being a 10-year-old and his stutter and how hard it was to get through that and how he used to recite W.B. Yeats into the mirror all the time so that he would just progress past that. And we spoke about loss and whatnot, you know, his family and mine. And, you know, he just said at the end of that, at the conversation, he said, Greg, if I had your talent, I would be president. So it was just, you know, it was a lovely thing to see, you know, 7-6 years later, you know, apparently, Mr. President, you do and have it in abundance, you know. So beautiful story.
Thank you for sharing that. You met Mark Shapiro when you took his conducting class a couple of years ago. Why did you want to learn how to conduct?
Well, I wanted to learn how to conduct because as a soloist, sometimes, you know, you want to get the most ideal picture of what you're trying to do. And you want to see it through the lens of the composer, how the conductor, you know, coordinates, how he or she just interacts. And once you have a fuller picture of the whole score, then it's easier to communicate with everybody. So I took Mark's course and it was truthfully tremendous and it was so much fun. And I think, you know, we had this great rapport where he would never really mind pushing me to a level, you know, where I needed to be pushed, but you would have that little bit of pushback, you know. So we developed this really fun way of understanding each other's boundaries and working together and exploring music. You know, it was a phenomenal 2 years, highly recommendable, but phenomenal 2 years taking his course.
That fun relationship, that fun class has turned into a new collaboration on your recording Glass Hour. And Mark, when you first met Gregory, did you imagine, you know, that you would become collaborators in this way?
No, what a happy surprise that turned out to be. It was wonderful.
So how would you describe this collaboration?
It was really fun. So as Greg said, when we met in the class, we had a kind of rapport. I think our senses of humor really gel. And there's so much about humor that can be unspoken, and we just kind of clicked that way. So I think Greg was looking for someone that he felt he could really trust. And I, as a conductor, I have a kind of split personality of course, we all like to be in control. But I also really like to help other people be their best. It's really, for me, what comes to the heart of conducting. And I think Greg kind of sensed maybe those two values and felt that if he was going to schlep somebody all the way to Ostrava, that it would be good to do this together. So we did, and the rest is history, and Greg has lots of terrific photos.
When you talk about building trust, what does that look like for the two of you?
I mean, for me, it was really about making sure I have a little thing of KGH, keep Greg happy. So it was really about making sure that Greg could be maximally comfortable all the time in this role. I had a lot of respect for his initiative and moxie in putting together this project. It was a lot to organize. It was a lot to conceive of. And Greg is really entrepreneurial, and I wanted this to be really a good experience for him and to do everything I could to make sure that that happened and to make sure that the orchestra had a good experience also, but that they were really supportive of him. So for me, that was sort of the task as I understood it.
Greg, can you talk about the conception of this project? I mean, what did it entail for you?
Well, I had heard the American Four Seasons a number of years ago, and there are two beautiful recordings. Gidon Kremer's recording, where you always feel that there's nothing he can do wrong to a certain degree, and the premiere by Robert McDuffie with Maren Alsop. And they were so very different and incredible recordings. And I felt that work really spoke to me, where I said, I can actually bring something completely unique to this, something that hasn't been recorded, that hasn't been said. It doesn't really matter if people like it or don't like it. It's really pure me. So that was the first thing. And then the second part of it was, you know, this was a 40, 45 minute concerto. How do we round out the disc? And I've loved making transcriptions. I've been making them for the last 10 years, whether it's Solo Bach or Johnny Cash or Nine Inch Nails or a little bit of Debussy, whatever that is, and for different ensembles. So I, you know, having heard the hours and being, again, and any music you choose, you always have to feel that tremendous emotional connection. So I researched it, and I was writing, and I was making notes, and I decided that the best thing to do was create a new work based on the hours, a concert suite for violin and orchestra, and very much in the vein of those Milstein and Heifetz transcriptions of decades ago, of that golden age of violin playing, you know. And I was lucky enough to have, or I was fortunate enough where Eric Friedman, I'd studied him with him for a number of years, and he was a pupil of Heifetz and Milstein. So that sort of feeling and reminiscing through his lessons just seemed to be a very logical way to deal with this. And, you know, from dealing with the Glass Company and Sony ATV and whatnot, I think we came up with a beautiful, beautiful project. And it's something new, and it's something that people haven't heard before. And it's something to, you know, what's the right word? Just to allow people to sit, listen, and escape.
Greg, what did you learn from Eric Friedman that you were able to apply directly to this new arrangement?
I think it's more a feeling. Eric and I got on really, really well. And he was, I think what I loved about him was he was just so black and white about it. You know, it was, this will work and this won't work. And if you don't fix this, you'll never do anything. You know, he was very much, I think with teachers, it's knowing what to say, what the student needs, and when to say it. And I think he just completely read what I needed and knew how to give it to me. So that was the first part. But I think the stories that he used to tell and how he used to produce sound in that old school way that you don't necessarily hear as much of anymore. And, you know, I think explaining in a way of violin playing in a way that just made so much vocal sense to me and allowed for expression to be who you are. I think that was the one thing that was phenomenal. It was just, you can do what you want. You can voice how you want as long as you take care of these principles. And therefore the individuality of who you are and your unique voice will always come to the fore. So I think with that and the, not only his stories about Heifetz and Milstein and Oistrakh, you know, I think that was what drove me to really explore the transcription and allow my voice just really to come to the fore.
When this is an original work by a composer like Philip Glass, a living composer, where did he come into play in this process? Did you have to get permission from him to be able to create this arrangement?
Yes. So I went to his company and we went through all the rights and whatnot and what we could and what we couldn't do. And their thing was you can't harmonically change the work, but you can artistically create whatever transcription you want. So rather than just take the melodies that were there, it was a beautiful way just to, as I say, explore and create a work that can exist in the violin repertoire as a new concert work. So it's none of what was written really for violin existed. The harmonies are the same, the voicing is different, the orchestration is different. And it, I mean, especially now, works for violin and string orchestra have a little bit more, during the pandemic, I think a little bit more relevancy. You know, who knows when we're going to fully come through this, but yeah, it was an interesting work to create. And you know, we just made sure that everything from the rights from Sony to Paramount to the Philip Glass company, they just signed off on everything on every step of the way.
Mark, when you heard this new arrangement or you were informed of it, maybe you're looking at the score, the Hours Suite, what was your first thought when you saw it?
I thought it was really effective. So I think that music has a really haunting quality. And the arrangement captured something that Greg said earlier today, this feeling, I think during the pandemic especially, we need this moment of kind of reflection and something about the passage of time, how we understand our lives situated in the flow of time. And the arrangement really captured that. You could feel it was very interesting, I think, in Ostrava. This is not the repertoire they mostly play, this orchestra, but you could feel even from day one to day two, the way they found the groove and the mood and the vibe of this, and you could see them really starting to relate to it. It was really extraordinary.
This recording does explore the concept of time. In the Hours Suite, it's time on a daily basis, and I'm curious how your perception of time may have changed or be altered now in this past year during the pandemic, and both of you can respond to that if you'd like.
After you, Greg.
Well, I was going to say I'm going to defer to you, Mark. What's interesting for me is that the pandemic, and I think it's hard for those in different industries to understand how musicians and performing artists have been affected. It's almost like a loss of our voice. And there's just a huge void there of not being able to give to others and not being able to give to a live audience. And, you know, so for me, I found the last 12 months of the pandemic, there's a sense of Groundhog Day to it where the days can go tremendously slowly, but the year, I realize, has gone very quickly. And Mark can talk a little bit more about this. And so there was a lovely juxtaposition in the Hour Suite being time on a daily basis. And this is what he spoke, he was talking to me about, and the Four Seasons on a yearly basis. So, you know, that there's parallels of what we've been going through for the last year, I mean, in this music.
Yeah, absolutely. I would offer that today, actually, coincidentally, I mentioned to Greg, is the 1 year anniversary of my last live performance. And one really, you know, if you're talking about the flow of time, that's a very significant feeling that, you know, something one has been doing for so long, one just hasn't done. And I think, as Greg said, it's a loss of kind of groundedness. For me, it's almost one's identity is a little bit misplaced. You know, you think, where did that go? And there's also, in conducting, you're very nourished by the sound of the ensemble and the response of the ensemble. It's a kind of food. So even though, like many of us, I've put on a few pounds during the pandemic, there's another aspect where I really feel a hunger for that feeling of the being in a real place with real sound, with the sound coming at you. It's challenging.
To follow on from that, you know, I find that the thing that I feed on most is that in the moment reaction from an audience, whether that's a purely classical audience, whether sometimes that's a crossover audience, but you feel the energy. And that's the part that I won't say I'm addicted to, but it really drives me. In the middle of the performance, you know you can turn an emotion on a note by creating just something different and feeling that energy back. So I think that, to me, is what I've missed tremendously. I've done one or two virtual performances, which have been really interesting to get on stage and make music, but it's still not the same as being, whether that's five people in audience or, you know, 2,000 people, whatever your number is, you always want to feel that live, tangible, or intangible, I should say, emotion and feedback.
The American Four Seasons by Philip Glass, which is his Violin Concerto No. 2, explores the passing of time through the seasons, and he does it very fluidly, not in a specific way, the way like Vivaldi's Four Seasons is. Can you talk a little bit about that freedom that he offers you as a performer, Greg?
Absolutely. You know, when Maestro Glass created this and the premiere came with Robert McDuffie, they were corresponding and they both had different ideas of what seasons were which. So he's left this up to the audience to decide for themselves which movement correlates to which season. And I think that there's a lovely active participation then by the audience member, you know, rather than just a passive participation. So you can really sort of feel what you feel, you know, as an audience member. I know for me, and Mark and I have actually spoken about this a little bit, you know, I had very strong feelings about that second movement being My Winter. Just that feeling of starkness and just growing from nothing and colour ever so slowly coming into that piece. And then just really, really growing. So that for me was winter. The fourth movement was a definite summer. It was just that hustle and bustle and just virtuoso and just non-stop go. It is different for everyone. But I think it's lovely that it's put up to the audience for them to make their own opinion and their own conclusion.
There are little songs in between each of the movements. What do those songs represent?
Those songs are in place of the cadenza. So normally in a concerto, at the end of each movement, or definitely the first movement, depending on the period, you will have the composer's cadenza or the cadenza by a different soloist or even the individual performer's cadenza. Structurally, he created something different here where he just put a prelude, a solo prelude before each movement. And the idea was that they could also be performed together as a set separate to the concerto. So they're just basically smaller pieces in lieu of the cadenza within each movement.
The Janáček Philharmonic is the ensemble that you're leading on this recording, Mark. Why are they so well suited to perform the music of Philip Glass?
Well, it's something that was really striking about working with them. They make themselves available for a lot of recording work, is that they have, and I think Greg could speak to this too, they have a real sense of string playing that was very organic to that ensemble. I think we live in a world where things can become very homogeneous all over the world. But there is, I think in a community like that, a lot of them have studied with the same teachers. I think a lot of them work with the same instrument makers. And there is a kind of community of sound that is very distinctive that they make. And something that absolutely fascinated me, I think it's something I like to do as a conductor anyway, both with a soloist like Greg and with an ensemble, is really listen to the other party and just see what are they bringing to the table. They had so many intuitions right away about how they wanted to play, how they wanted to sound. So it became clear to me that the opportunity was really to have them find their way, given the way they play, into this music. And they're a really musical ensemble. It was really a pleasure.
Mark, maybe you could. There was one moment where, because there was a language barrier, and we had a wonderful producer, an engineer, and we would say things that we wanted to tell the orchestra. We would, you know, collaborate between ourselves and just figure out things that we needed to do, but we would also talk to the orchestra through the producer. But there was one moment that I must say I loved seeing, and I think you were trying to work with the cellos.
I wonder if you're going to tell the story I'm thinking. Yeah.
Well, I was actually going to say, I hope you do tell this story, because like from the third party looking in, it just made so much sense. So I'll let you.
All right. Okay. So there was one moment where we were trying to elicit a certain mood of tenderness. And I looked at the cellist, who was a bit grumpy looking and, you know, of a certain age and position. And I asked the interpreter what the Czech word was for lullaby. And the cellist recognized the word. I think it's a close approximation in Czech. And he just melted. And the next time he played what he was playing, it had such humanity. And you could see, I'm thinking he must have had a grandchild, and you could just see that something in him completely understood what to do. And the more I'm involved in music, those are the things that matter so much, is the human expression that music is all about. Sometimes we get very technical, but really we're expressing things that are in our heart and soul. And that moment was, I was proud of that. That was a moment of real connection that I think Greg and I both remember very vividly.
What are you hoping listeners will appreciate most about this recording?
I think freshness. I think an interpretation that doesn't have the constraints of a certain school or whatnot. But
it's very personal, the way you play it.
Yeah, I think just something that's just really unique and allows them escape and coming with open ears, just to go on a journey and see where that line takes them. I think that's the nicest way to put it.
A new recording called Glass Hour, featuring violinist Gregory Harrington, the Janáček Philharmonic, and conductor Mark Shapiro. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer for New Classical Tracks. Since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy. It's the Piano Puzzler Podcast. Every week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. He takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer, and then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. Subscribe to The Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker.